It's 93.3 WMMR, and we have the pleasure of the company of Brandon Flowers. Good day, sir.
Hello.
Nice to have you on this, I believe, the final show of the North American Lake, correct? Tonight?
That's right. Tonight's number 30, but who's counting?
And you also did Europe, so you have your sea legs, and you've done shows in between during the pandemic, but these are the first full two tours, right?
Yeah, this is we've got about 60 gigs under our belt already. I can't believe that that number exists now. When we were looking down the list, it just seemed like a mountain, and it's incredible to be almost on top of it now, yeah.
It's so cool. When you think about bands, so many legendary bands formed as a result of ads that were answered in a newspaper. And if I understand correctly, and that, of course, today wouldn't happen with digital age and everything. But when you think about the fact that, if I understand correctly, you answered an ad to join these guys, is that correct?
That's right. And when I explain it now, even you just mentioning it, it sounds so outdated. And that's a part of my history is kind of surreal. Of course, we've seen everything change so rapidly. But, yeah, it's kind of romantic, you know. And I think that's a part of the band that people do gravitate towards.
Well, there's a magic here. And on this tour, you've had some cool moments. But one comes to mind in New York City at Madison Square Garden where you said, "We've been sweating bullets," as the encore arrives, and you're in his backyard, you're in his room, and you bring out Bruce Springsteen, and the Killers effectively become the E Street Band, and you play Badlands and Born to Run and Dustland. And how did that come to be?
You know, over lockdown, we did a version of Dustland with Bruce that was sort of, I guess you could call it, quote unquote, you know, the quarantine version. And it was something that we wanted to release for fans, and you know, everything was shut down. People weren't doing shows, and we had become friends over the last few years. And he's been, I don't know. I don't want to say he's taking me under his wing, but he has just been a little bit of a mentor, and he's just a great inspiration for us. And so he had mentioned that he's getting ready to go on tour again, and that one day he'd like to join us on stage, and the stars aligned for us in New York City, and we practiced the hell out of
I was wondering about the practice.
Out of Badlands and out of Born to Run. I don't think we've ever practiced anybody else's songs as much as we did those songs, and we were we were ready.
And he brought Jake Clemens, the big man's nephew, to play sax.
That's right, yeah.
Now, there's so many moments in the band's history, but with Imploding the Mirage being out, even though it was released 2 years ago, there's so many cool things that happen on the album. And one of the things I love about the Killers is the fact that you'll release a song, Caution comes to mind, and then it's not uncommon, and you did this on Pressure Machine as well, to release alternative versions. And then there was the Wasatch version. Am I saying it correct?
That's right. That's right.
I love that you do that, but why do you do that?
I think it's been interesting for us to sometimes it's just something that we stumble upon because we have to do a different version for a TV show, or I think that came about, again, because it started to sound like a broken record. But during the pandemic, we couldn't get a whole band together. So only me and Ronnie would be available sometimes to record a song. And so the Wasatch version of Caution is a keyboard, a drum machine, and me and Ronnie trying to do our best to find that song. And you find a whole different version of it. And so that's an instance where it was just, we just had to.
There's so many cool things about Imploding the Mirage, but I'm a fan of albums and album artwork, and Thomas Blackshear is the artist that you gravitated towards, and if I understand correctly, during recording, you blew up rudimentary images of some of the artwork that appealed to you and put it up on the walls of the studio, and sometimes would go to those images for inspiration. Can you describe the images and what inspired you about them?
Yeah, so it was, you hear about people having mood boards and things like that in studios, or there are people that I know that'll put up, you know, legends, you know, Brian Eno or Brian Ferry or something like that, just to remember what they're shooting for or whatever. And I thought, I came across this one in particular image from Thomas Blackshear, And like you said, we blew it up and it became a member of the band. I had already written a couple of songs and I saw this connection. It's this Blackshear, you know, he either does like a Western landscapes or he does spiritual, like Christian things. And I saw them combined in this one image, and it's called The Dance of the Wind and the Rain, I think. And we used that as, yeah, like I said, it joined the band. It became a place I went to when I was looking for a missing lyric or for a vibe of a song. I was so grateful for that experience. It was really cool.
What was his reaction to wanting to use the artwork officially on the cover and throughout the record?
I think it just kind of hit him out of nowhere, you know. And then we also allowed us to use other images for single art. So each single that was released is accompanied by a Blackshear piece, and it just gave this cohesion to the record, and it felt really organic. And I think he was thrilled. We finally got to meet him, and when we played in Denver last month, and he's a really cool guy.
It speaks to the depth of albums, of the three-dimensional nature of a record album. I always encourage my listeners, I've been on for 40 years, to buy the record, if not vinyl, which I still love, the CD, and spend some time with the record.
Yeah, I know. I mean, we have Johnny Marr here with us on the road, and I mean, I still remember what it felt like to open up the Smiths cassette and pull out Louder Than Bombs had like 27 songs on it. So the liner notes there was a lot. It was like an accordion when you unfolded all of that and it was orange. And I remember reading the credits and the lyrics and
even a smell to it when you get into vinyl.
Yeah. So it was I definitely am grateful for those experiences that I had. Yeah. I felt more connected to the record than just loving the songs. It felt like, you know, you had a part of them somehow.
My friend Bill, who's a huge Killers fan, loves the song, and I've played it for him on the air several times, My Own Soul's Warning. Yeah. I think it opens Imploding the Mirage on the CD. Tell me what that is for you.
Yeah, it was the last song that we wrote, and I was trying to tackle some pretty big subjects on the record. A big part of the record was about becoming reconciled to God, and also maybe becoming reconciled to your partner and your wife, and two people growing together and becoming one, and all of these things. And I realized that there was this redemption aspect that I hadn't covered, and it was how I needed to overcome what I needed to overcome to become a real man and be the husband that my wife deserves and the dad for my kids, and that was where My Own Soul's Warning was born. And so it's weird to talk about things like repentance and forgiveness and things like that, but that was something that I felt like I needed on this record, and it was the finishing piece of the puzzle for sure.
Well, a lot of your songs touch on redemption and a higher. To me, they're very spiritual. Just a couple questions on Pressure Machine. You've discovered wanting to escape from Nephi, is that how you say it?
Nephi, yeah.
Okay, Utah, and then discovering, as many of us do, that we can't really escape from where we came from. And there's so many cool songs. But what I love about this record are these little, I would call them almost like a little mini play. There's verbal messages or a little play acting out before almost every song. Yeah. Such a cool idea.
Yeah, I learned a new word for those, interstitials.
Interstitials.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's what they're called. That's what they're called. And I did not know it beforehand. And it was a last minute idea. So we knew that this record took place in Nephi, Utah. Every song needed to take place there. And at the very last second, Sean Everett, our producer, had this idea to go interview people in Nephi. So those people are real people and real stories and the real accent of this place that I, you know, spent my formative years. Yeah.
I mean, there's so many great songs on there, one of which is Terrible Thing. Yeah. And you speak about the plight with such empathy of, a young gay kid who is considering committing suicide and might not be accepted there. And it's very powerful, as the whole record is powerful. It's very stark in a way, but very soulful. And I'm wondering how that squares with your Mormon faith. I love that you do it, but sometimes the Mormon church historically has not been that friendly to the gay community.
Yeah, I think it comes from me working through my own understanding of the plight of somebody that is gay and that is born in a religious community. My church has made great strides in the last 20 years, I would say, to in this area, but we're still got a long way to go, I would say. But and so, yeah, I'm completely allowed to disagree with some of the way things are handled and still remain in good standing.
Can you be gay and be a Mormon?
You can, and there are members of the church that are, but it's not the healthiest situation with what is prescribed to them at this moment. They basically are asked to be celibate, and so if I had a child that was a homosexual, I wouldn't tell them that they need to stay with me at church and be celibate. I think we're not meant to be alone. Otherwise, Adam, you know, we believe in Adam and Eve. You know, man's not meant to be alone. And
Adam and Steve.
So like I said, we're allowed to. It's not so strict that you can't disagree with where that is right now. And it's a tough one. It's the most difficult issue I think that our church is facing right now. Absolutely.
We're speaking with Brandon Flowers on MMR. The white arrows you refer to in Boy, you've described as your kids and your wife and the songs and the stage. What do they look like to you?
Oh.
Like a powerful blast from the Jedi, you know.
No, I think it could be as simple as lights on your path, you know, that are helping you find your feet and find your way and make your way. It doesn't have to be a giant floodlight.
Three more quick questions. One of them, there's so many positive messages that you have continually put out over the years. And as I view the world, I am a natural optimist, and yet there's so much negativity out there in the way we don't get along with each other in politics, in violence, in climate change, wherever you want to call it. And yet you put out this positive message. Where do you draw that from? How do you stay positive?
I get it from my parents for sure. I have been really blessed with two great parents who stayed together and who were sort of eternally optimistic. And sometimes they had no reason to be. and I definitely inherited that. And the way that I was raised in the church that I was raised, always trying to look for the God's hand in your life and being taught to reflect this light of Christ that we believe that everyone's born with. And I'm going to sound like a sycophant here, but no, those are positive things and messages that I was raised with. And so I think that it's definitely seeps its way into my outlook and into my songwriting.
When I see Bruce, and I've seen him a million times, I feel like he's an old tent revival preacher, you know, because he's calling the flock, if you will, to order in any arena or stadium he's playing. Two songs that just slay me to this day are your cover of the Dire Straits' Romeo and Juliet. I'm a hopeless romantic anyway, and so, but your take on that is, again, so soulful.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, no, I feel embarrassed to say it, but I had just recently found out about that song when we recorded it. So I think what you're picking up on is this, I fell in love with it. It wasn't this thing that I knew about and was like, it was like, have you guys heard this Dire Straits song? You know, I was obviously familiar with Money for Nothing and Sultan's a Swing and stuff like that, but I didn't know about this one. So you caught me, you know, in the middle of a love affair with that song, and I think I really was able to pick up on what Mark was, you know, was trying to lay down.
The other song that just carries me away, I think a great musical thing is a song has a power to take you on a journey for 3 or 4 or 5 minutes to this magical place, bring you back safely to earth, and transform you for the positive in that experience. And to me, Human does that to me every time. You know, you've been asked about the meaning of it. I'm not asking you about that. The textures, your voice, the way the music coincides and builds, it just, sometimes I cry when I hear it, sometimes I'm energized. It just is magical to me.
It's magical to us too. And it's something that you can't put your finger on. There's something about Stuart Price's production and decisions that he'd made that you just couldn't do it again. And the marriage of the words and the chords, and it's one of those things that when you're in a band that you're crossing your fingers for, and we've been lucky to be a part of it, more than once, and I count myself among the lucky ones. But yeah, Human's one of them, man.
Weezer has a song called Records, and in it Rivers sings that I've got records in my head, and he'll say everything from Madonna to Nirvana. And I notice in my everyday life, I have music always in my head. I wake up with a song. I go to bed with a song. During the day, if I'm not near live music or being on the radio, there's always a song playing. I'm wondering if that's the case for you.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's definitely, I can't escape it at this point, but it's always been there. I go back to my parents again, but they always had music on. The way I would find my mom in a grocery store was she would be whistling somewhere, and you'd find her what aisle she was in real quick, and so it's just part of us. Yeah.
Thank you so much for spending some time with us at WMMR.
Thanks for having me. Hello, everybody. This is Brandon Flowers from The Killers, and you're listening to Pierre Robert on WMMR.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.